Tonight we're going to talk about end time prophecies. Chuck Missler is our special guest. We're going live to New Zealand in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Longtime Coast to Coast favorite guest Chuck Missler received a congressional appointment to the U.S. Naval Academy and then served in the U.S. Air Force after leaving active duty. He became branch chief of the Department of Guided Missiles at Lawry Air Force Base. Chuck has worked as a systems engineer, followed by a senior analyst position at TRW, serving both the intelligence community and the Department of Defense. He also worked at the Ford Motor Company, where he established the very first international computer network. Here he is. He's way out there in New Zealand, Chuck Missler. Hey, Chuck, how are you?
Delighted to be with you again, George. Nice to have you. Nice to be part of your team here. This is great.
Oh, my pleasure, too. How are things in New Zealand? I know they've had some rough earth catastrophes of late.
Yeah, in the South Island. We're in the middle of the North Island, but in the South Island, yes, they had a very serious earthquake. And what's disturbing is apparently it is its depth. I think it goes 10 kilometers down, which means it wasn't just a fault. It was a crustal move of some kind. And that's exactly why the Japanese thing is so startling. So there, among people who really study these things, there's quite a disturbing anxiety going on, because these things are structurally very different than what we experienced in the past. Not only in terms of their severity, but also in terms of the structural implications. So I gather within that community, there's a lot of concern.
There's some severe concern here, Chuck, about Los Angeles and whether Southern California is going to get hit by one. And also, of course, the New Madrid Fault in the Midwest area of this country. So, I don't know. It just, we all sense something. Do you get that feeling out there?
Very much so. And I think that there's an atmosphere, I think, globally in a number of different zones. That's why there are a lot of people that are talking about the beginning of birth pangs. That's one of the phrases that occurs in some of the biblical passages, and about which there's a lot of misunderstandings, by the way. But there is clearly a growing apprehension among people who know their Bible seriously, and also among those who have no biblical knowledge but are aware that something's going on, indeed.
What is new with you? What brings you to New Zealand, Chuck?
Well, we have sort of established a second base down here. We have a think tank of sorts, a Christian think tank that's on the Internet, and we have members now in virtually 70 countries around the world. But we have been on the radio daily in Australia, New Zealand for over 10 years. And so we have a following down here. So to help support that, we have a second base. Our primary base, of course, is in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Mm-hmm. But we have a second base here. We're on about 40 acres that are surrounded on three sides by the Waikato River, which is the primary river through New Zealand. And we have our own airstrip. And my wife and I have a little cottage that we can hang out when we're down here. So we're down here for a few weeks to solidify our programs down here. We're planning to, we have an operating lodge here, which does, corporate conferences, that sort of thing. But we're also planning to add some facilities and programs here for a Christian discipleship center. And so we're pretty excited about that. And so we're using the commercial lodge to help pay the bills, but we're actually developing a Christian outreach, on a face-to-face immersion kind of operation down here.
We call it good for you.
Yeah, so that's our, as you probably know, that's our think tank, by the way, is unique in that it's a Christian think tank. It's all volunteer, but we have an intelligence network now that spans the globe, and we try to keep an eye on the broad strategic trends that have biblical relevance, and we've been doing that for over 10 years, and so that's probably one of our long suits. One of the things we're best known for isn't just in-depth Bible studies. We're non-denominational, but very fundamental. But the other thing we're known for is because of our commitment to the what we call the intelligence network. And clearly, whether you're looking geopolitically at the Middle East or whether you're looking at the decline of the West, the rise of Asia, clearly there's huge, very fundamental structural changes going on, so much so that most of what we've grown up to presume is increasingly becoming invalid. So that means anyone that's responsible as a steward for their families or their communities needs to be aware of the realities that are changing so dramatically, especially in the United States.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's an interesting time for us to stand back and really reassess what's real, because so much of what we've grown up over the last many several decades is turning out to be increasingly invalid. And so, like any form of stewardship, it really demands a valid perspective. The most precious thing is a valid perspective. If you have a valid perspective, you know what questions to ask, and you can always get answers to those questions. The real trick is to know what questions to ask. And the only real barrier to truth is the presumption that we already have it. And almost anything else, you can overcome. But this presumption that we think we know, when we're what we think we know is really wrong, is can lead to disaster. And and we're certainly finding that out as you analyze the U.S. From a financial point of view. It's really astonishing to see the predicament that we're plunging into.
And even though it has taken years to get us in the position we're in now, Chuck, it just seemed like the bottom fell out all of a sudden, doesn't it?
Very much so. Very much so. And for lots of different reasons. Much of the things that many of us consider the cause are really symptoms rather than the cause. And the leadership in Washington being an example is that there's a more fundamental change that's going on in the fabric of American society. The thing I like to point out, for an example, George, is this: we have a new word in our vocabulary. It's called trillion. And I have yet to find anyone that can really, really grasp what a trillion is. And what I've learned, what's useful, is to talk in terms of seconds. We have 60 seconds to a minute and so on. If I owed you some money and I told you I will pay you back in a million seconds, you get out your calculator and you quickly discover that's 12 days. You can live with that.
I can live with that.
I'd say, I'm sorry, George, I misspoke. I'll pay you back in a billion seconds, with a B, that is. Well, you get your calculator out, you discover that's 32 years. That's not only a quantitative difference, that's qualitatively different.
That's right. Something I can't live with. Yeah.
Exactly. But then I say, oh, I'm sorry, George, I didn't mean billion. I'll pay you back in a trillion seconds. And that turns out to be 32,000 years. So when you go from million, billion, a trillion in seconds, you're going from 12 days to 32 years and then to 32,000 years. And the point is, of course, that the minute you start talking trillions, you've gone beyond any rational reach of any government, let alone the U.S. We have an economy of about $14 trillion. We have an annual deficit that is presently about $1.7 trillion, getting worse. And we depend, 40 cents of every dollar that Washington spends has to be borrowed from foreigners. And the foreign central banks aren't stupid. They realize they'll never get repaid. So there's an exit worldwide from the U.S. dollar. And most Americans have no grasp of what that's going to imply when the U.S. dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency. It is at the moment, but that role is eroding very quickly. And when it does, that's going to be accompanied with huge multiplications, really, of commodity costs, whether it's food, energy, what have you. And so the implication, and that milestone is months away, not years away. And so this is something that the media, and both Wall Street and Washington, are working very hard to hide. Most people are not really aware of all of this, unless they're professional investors. The people who subscribe to the really competent advisory services are aware of all of this. It's not quite as clear as what to do, of course, but that's why there's a substantial panic going on in many of the boardrooms, because the basic ground rules that we've built our lives on for several decades are suddenly subject to some fundamental structural changes. So it's a time of apprehension in a number of sectors. Geopolitically, of course, we've spent $600 billion on Libya already.
I know.
There are 191 Tomahawk missiles and all of that. What disturbs me more than the actual numbers is the fact that it's being done outside the rule of law, that we've actually gone to war without Congress approving it. And there's just a disregard of constitutional structure. There's a disregard of the rule of law. And that bothers me more fundamentally than all the other aspects is that there is just a widespread abandonment of constitutional protections.
It's going to turn around and bite us, Chuck. It's going to catch up to us, isn't it?
It really will. And that's one of the reasons I'm flattered to be part of your program, because you're one of the programs that has had the reach to reach into the fringe areas in a number of ways. And I was quite startled to realize how many people watch your program, because I've gotten emails from all over the country of people that are aware that I was going to be your guest tonight. And so I was intrigued. Even though it airs at a very late hour, it has quite a following, and that's a bouquet to you, my friend. You've done a good job on a task that's not easy to acquit yourself on, to navigate along the edges of popular views, and I think that's exciting.
Well, we saw something, Chuck, a long time ago, even farther back when you were last with me in 2006. We just saw episodes and events changing on this planet at such a rapid clip. And as I talked to my staff, I said, we have to be able to cover these things quickly with cutting edge guests like yourself, because if we don't, the mainstream media is not, and people are going to get blindsided when this stuff occurs. So we were a couple years ahead of this economic mess with some of the people who've been on our show, Chuck, talking about the possibilities, what could happen, and they were right. Whether it was the economy or some emerging virus or some non-virus, you name it, that's what we do. So we stick our necks out there, but, you know, I think we have to.
Well, I'm glad you do, because one of the things that is disturbing to discover, I think most people in public life have known for decades that there's a very liberal bias, as they call it, in the media. But I think that the 2008 elections were a laboratory test to show us something else. It's not just a bias. There is a deliberate corruption in the mainline media, because they've gone to such extremes to hide the truth from the American people. And that should, in a democracy, that should be called treason, because the purpose of the media in a democracy is to inform the electorate. But in the 2008 elections is a wonderful laboratory exercise to demonstrate how, to what extremes the media has gone to hide the basic facts that the public's entitled to. What I'm alluding to, of course, is the fact that we've got a man in the White House that nobody has seen any grades from kindergarten on. No one's encountered any classmates that he had in any of his courses. There's the most astonishing vacuum of any information whatsoever on his background. And this is not a question of failing to vet things. This is a question of going to elaborate legal maneuvers to hide these things. And I'm not talking just about the birth certificate. There's just a long list of these things. And as you watch this, again, I regard the Obama thing as a symptom, not the cause of our problems.
Right.
But clearly there is corruption in the media. There's corruption in the courts. There's corruption in our educational system. As you look through our society, you suddenly realize that the compromise and corruption of our basic institutions is widespread. And this really derives from an apathy and a complacency and a what have you, that's a basic property within the electorate that I don't think, see, this is what you really come down to, say, gee, okay, well, what do we do about it? For me, this is unusual, because I'm intrinsically an optimistic guy, but I stand back and I don't know, I can't see that there is a point of correction. I can't see any leadership that is going to really be effectual to somehow turn the tide here. I think we're on a slippery rock. I think we're financially beyond the point of no return. And again, I regard all of these things as derivatives from a basic moral breakdown. And the kind of values that we grew up with in the 50s and 60s have evaporated. As we legislate God out of the schools, as we try to remove any absolutes from our society. It's astonishing to realize how the primary institutions in America are out promoting immorality in whatever form they can. The attack on the family, the attack on marriage, the attack on life itself, on it goes. So as you stand, now it's interesting, several executives that I travel with that are in international roles, they all point out something to me that's interesting. When you physically are in the United States, you don't see it. But the minute you travel into Europe or into Asia or away from the U.S., it is so obvious, it's stunning.
Right.
The irrational decisions and the what mystifies executives in Europe and also executives in Asia isn't just the strange decisions that are being made in Washington and in Wall Street, is that it's the attitude they see. It's business as usual. It's as if they don't get it. They don't realize our problem is too much debt. And the answer isn't to add more debt. As I usually joke, I say the first law of holes is to stop digging, you know. And so, but in any case, we're really off into a particular bramble bush here in your program. I didn't want to spend all our time that we have just on the decline of the West thing.
But it ties into end times, though, Chuck, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. One of the things that it used to be as I traveled, you know, I've done this for, three or four decades now. As I used to travel, one of the questions I always used to get from any mixed audience, we always, after we do a presentation with a large audience, typically 1,000 people, whatever, we always finish with what we call a question-and-answer time, where we just throw it open to any questions. There were two questions I could always predict would come up sooner or later. One is, where is the United States in Bible prophecy? All kinds of people have published conjectures over the years. But everybody that does a serious study of biblical prophecy is confronted with the reality that all the players in the end times are very well identified. And what is conspicuous is the United States is not identifiable in any of those, not in any sound scholastic way. And somebody wonders why. And it used to be that was one of the big mysteries. Today, you don't get that question so much because most people who are in the know realize that in terms of the geopolitical power structure, there's a whole shift that between the Middle East, the whole issue is between the Middle East and Asia. Even Europe has got sort of a backseat these days. And that's another debate that some people engage in. But the main point is the one question we always just get asked, where's the United States in prophecy? The other question that we used to get, especially from the more spiritually mature audiences, the question would come up is, why hasn't God judged America? You know, Billy Graham quipped several decades ago so cleverly, he says, if God doesn't judge America, he'll have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's a great soundbite, but it gets the point across, is that when you look at the commitment of the American culture to exclude God from the schools, to exclude prayer from the public domain and so forth, you wonder that how long is God going to ignore that, so to speak? Well, there is, as you study the judgments of God, there's about four different kinds of wraths of God, one of which, the most conspicuous one, is what's called the abandonment wrath. When Samson had that last visit with Delilah, and he went to break loose, and he discovered that God had abandoned him, what a shock that must have been for him. Just simply not giving him the strength that he had come to take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happens to the northern kingdom. After Solomon dies, there is, of course, a civil war, and Israel divided into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. In the northern kingdom, God sends Hosea up there to lay down his indictment, and from Hosea chapter 4 through the end of that book to 14, it's basically, it's not a preachment, gee, repent or else. No, God lays out, says that the northern kingdom has joined itself to idols, leave them alone. In other words, God's judgment against that country was just to abandon the support that he previously given them.
Hold on for one second, Chuck. We're going to take this break. We'll be back. And our special guest tonight, Chuck Mishler, we're going back live to New Zealand to talk with Chuck about end times prophecy in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Chuck, I opened up all my coast-to-coast emails this morning in preparation of tonight's program, and I had 666 emails waiting for me this morning. And I saw that number, and I went, Man, he's after us today.
That's a widely misunderstood number, but I hear you. Yeah,
sure is. Well, there's a group out there that thinks that May 21st is Judgment Day, that the many will be taken, many will be left behind. Then they say by October 21st, it's over for the rest of the planet. What's your take on this group?
Well, it's surprising that you have, and I won't mention names because there's no need to disparage specific people, but it's amazing how people who would manifest a posture of being Christian and biblically knowledgeable would crawl out on a limb and do exactly what the Bible prohibits, which is divination. No man knows the day nor the hour is emphasized again and again by our Lord, and yet these people who claim to be Christians publish books or pamphlets or whatever. There's a whole history of date setters. There's, in fact, you can go through a whole study of them through the centuries, really.
Mm-hmm.
People who, for whatever reason, come to some conclusion that the Lord is coming back on such and such a day, and it's so strange. I could understand that coming from people who are uninformed or non-believers or whatever, because they're in ignorance. But for people who proclaim a knowledge of the Scripture, to go ahead and deliberately do what is expressly prohibited. Prophecy is designed to glorify God, but divination, that is trying to predict from that, is prohibited. There's a subtle difference, but it's a very profound difference. And for people to go ahead and predict the second coming of Christ or the rapture or whatever is just contrary to what the Bible teaches. And the other thing I keep running into is the Mayan calendar.
Yeah.
And I have a fun one on that one, because obviously those that have studied the Mayan calendar have come to the conclusion that the world comes to an end on December 21st of the year 2012. And I love to point out that there is a 45-day error in the Mayan calendar. I say, really? I didn't know that. Yes, absolutely, because the world comes to an end on the second Tuesday in November of 2012. And it takes them 10 seconds to realize I'm talking about our national elections in the United States. And of course, I'm being facetious. But the point is that whether it's the Mayan calendar or Harold Camping's latest estimate or whatever, mm-hmm. These things, I think, are unfortunate because they cast biblical scholarship into an irrational direction.
It weakens it, doesn't it?
Very much so. They asked Mahatma Gandhi, very classically years ago, they asked Mahatma Gandhi, what is the biggest barrier to Christianity reaching India? And his answer was Christians. And it is a very graphic, it's tragic how many people who claim to be men of the cloth, so to speak, cast such a tragic disparagement on a true biblical position.
Is that a bird, by the way? Was that a bird in the back?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Because the roof on the house, it happens to be metal, and I get better recording. I'm sitting actually on the front porch because you got a better signal here. And
yeah.
So it's getting dark here, those are creatures out there, I guess.
Be careful.
Yeah, right. I didn't realize they're going to get that loud. I don't know what they are. The birds of some kind. And we love New Zealand. It's strange to see evergreen trees and tropical ferns growing side by side. It's a very, very idyllic environment. But in any case, getting back to the dating here, I think that it's one of the great tragedies in the Christian community is the biblical illiteracy. And I don't mean just in the rank and file. I'm talking about many pulpits. And one of the things that we're very committed to and what we're trying to do in our own clumsy way is to repair the biblical illiteracy. And anyone that studied Bible prophecy competently understands that setting dates is just an invitation to error.
Yes.
Because I think God has reasons for he's going to catch people by surprise. For in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh, and so forth. And watch and pray that you may become worthy to escape, and so forth. In other words, there's a doctrine in the New Testament that's very emphatic, which we call the doctrine of eminence, and that is that there's no intervening events that stands between here and his return, and that's deliberate for a number of reasons, part of which is that we should live our lives in an atmosphere of expectation, not setting dates. And the thing that would be fun to do, if you've got a candidate that's suggesting to your program that things going to happen on May 21st, that sounds to me like the setup for a very interesting wager.
It sure does. They refuse, Chuck, by the way. That's a Saturday. And I asked them all to come back on the show on Monday, the 23rd, and they say they can't. And I said, well, why not? And they said, because we're going to be gone.
Well, then we'll excuse them without a penalty. But the question also is, where on the earth? You see, right now, I'm a day ahead of you.
That's right.
Right now, I'm a day ahead of you. And if you want to know what tomorrow looks like, I can describe it to you. It's not bad. There's a little rain over there. So, in other words, I'm a day ahead. I'm a day ahead and, 5 hours behind, I guess.
Well, and if anybody's going to be taken up there, you're going to be one of them. I think you're going to be around. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm ready to collect on that bet if he wants to make a bet there, right? We should bet him $6.66.
Well, the other thing I did get from the organization shortly after the interview, this is the God's truth. I got a form to make a donation to them over incremental monthly payments.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You also wrote a book many years ago called Alien Encounters Book, which I still find it fascinating.
Yeah, that book is Dr. Mark Eastman and I did that together, and that book has got the strangest history. Originally, as we put that together on the UFOs, and I was going to get one of the astronauts. There were 13 choices to do a foreword, and I got in a stroke of genius, I think, I did something different. I had Douglas J. Marr do the foreword. Now, that's a name that most, unless they're in the New Age, they've never heard. But his Publishers Weekly attributes the whole New Age publishing craze to his book, Voyage to the New World, back in whatever it was years ago. And so his name is known to all the New Agers. What the New Agers don't know is that on November 9th of 1990, he became a Christian. But I had him do a foreword that doesn't manifest that. And if you look at Amazon.com, there are 17 book reviews. 15 are favorable. Don't bother with those. The two that are interesting, there's two that the guy is, not only are they negative, they're really angry. This one guy says, I had to read 9 chapters before discovering this was a Christian book. And that was exactly the strategy. We had the Cushell Peterson, which is the number one design firm in the Christian world, do the cover for us. And they did it pro bono for us, because they're just good friends. But the point is, they designed it deliberately to look New Agey. And if you go into a Christian bookstore, you don't find it in the Christian section. You find it in the New Age section, because it's one of those books that you can give to a friend who's a non-believer for Christmas or birthday or something, and he gets hooked because of the front end of it. But then, of course, it gets into the biblical implication of the UFOs and so forth. And what's astonishing is that the impact that crazy book has had over the years, in part because both Jacques Vallée, the Frenchman, and also J. Allen Hynek, the American, these are probably the two most respected researchers in that whole strange world.
Absolutely.
They both came to the conclusion, if you read their writings, that these things, whatever they are demonic. Because the contradiction is, they leave tangible evidences. They show up on multiple radars simultaneously. They're tangible on the one hand. On the other hand, they violate physical laws. They make right angle turns at incredible speeds. They go faster than the speed of sound without sonic boom. There's basic physics contradictions in them. And the tough part in that whole world, of course, is to sift out all the nonsense, all the hoaxes, and all the foolishness. But when you do, there's still a core group of well-documented events that indicate the reality of them. In fact, the real mystery in that world isn't what happened. What's the mystery is, why is it classified? when you study this, you discover something very strange, is that area of study, the UFO area, enjoys a security classification that's higher than our most sensitive warheads. And that fact itself is hard to find out, but it's true, because I found out that it's true. But the point is, the mystery about Roswell and some of these other events of history, those were, 67 years ago?
That's right.
Why are they still classified to this day? And so that's the real mystery. And so for some reason, and there's plenty of evidence of it happening, is that the information in this area is highly managed. It's not only barred, it's also kept alive in strange ways. And why is a subject in itself of study. But that book, Alien Encounters, is got to be, has one of the strangest histories, because there are more people that have come to a saving faith in the Bible through that book than many of the other.
Oh, I know. It is amazing.
Other things we've done.
It is amazing. I want your take on the Nephilim, Chuck, because, you know, all of this that we're talking about tonight is tying in to everything that we're talking about. It all has they're all pieces of a puzzle. Give me your take on the Nephilim.
Well, the Nephilim is, of course, the fallen ones. In the Greek, it's gigantes, meaning the earthborn. And it all tracks back, its roots, biblically, are in Genesis chapter 6. And what's so strange about that chapter is what it says is very clear and very corroborated in the New Testament as well as the Old. But strangely enough, many, many seminaries, I'll say even most seminaries, don't teach it straightforward. What the scripture clearly says is that there were some fallen angels that somehow embarked upon creating hybrids. The Nephilim are hybrids. What's interesting about the events of Genesis 6, and those events is what led to the flood of Noah. That's the reason for the flood of Noah. But in many seminaries, they soften that. They try to get away from the spookiness of it by some elaborate allegories that are just not correct. There's over a dozen textual refutations of what is commonly taught. If you take the biblical text, what it actually says, and you also recognize that in the New Testament, in three different places, it is confirmed what we call the angel view of Genesis 6, that these fallen angels somehow cohabited with human women to create hybrids. These hybrids were called Nephilim, the fallen ones, if you will, or the earthborn, if you will. What's interesting about the phenomenon is it is embodied in every cultural tradition on the planet Earth. If you study Greek mythology, you have the demigods, the Titan, the Hercules, and all these hybrids. And if you look at the American Indians, you can go through literally dozens of these ancient cultures. They all have the tradition of what they call the star people, what have you. These events in the memory of man are embodied in our mythologies as well. But getting back to the biblical record, the Nephilim were an attempt, apparently, to contaminate the human genome for a number of reasons. And the reason it becomes a hot topic in today's biblical scholarship is because Jesus makes a strange remark. He says, as the days of Noah were, so shall the days of the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, in a denotative sense, what he may have meant is simply that business as usual would continue. That's the way that passage is often interpreted. But people who studied it more carefully believe that what he's saying is something, to really understand what he's saying, you have to understand what the days of Noah were really like. So the flood was really an event that caused all but eight people, I should say actually nine people, because one was removed just before then, to be wiped out from the flood. And what's really strange, if you study it carefully, in Genesis chapter 6 verse 4, it says, and also after that, that same event that led to the flood of Noah reoccurred in the land of Canaan during the time that Israel was captive in Egypt. And after four centuries, they were to come back, and they did, and they encountered these things when Moses sends the spies in the land. They come back shook because 10 of the 12 spies said they're Nephilim in the land. We're like grasshoppers in their sight and so forth. These strange creatures were extant again. And that's why, strangely enough, Joshua is instructed when he goes in to conquer the land, there were four tribes that they were to wipe out every man, woman, and child of. When you read that, those passages as a New Testament reader, you're shocked. But that's exactly, there was some, you won't understand what's going on unless you really understand what the Nephilim are. The Nephilim show up in Numbers 13, verse 33, and so on. Anyway, the point is this whole area is pretty spooky.
It is.
That's why it's an area that's usually avoided by those that haven't really done their biblical homework. And but if you really, if you take the Bible seriously and you recognize, see, the great discovery, and this is probably a foundational issue here, is to discover that this, these 66 books we call the Bible, even though they were penned by over 40 different guys over a period of almost 2,000 years, that it's an integrated message. And when you discover what I mean by that is every number, every place name is there by deliberate design. And you have to discover that for yourself. But once you discover that, it has staggering implications because this message system, this package, was designed deliberately, and it had to have its origin outside time. And once you discover that, it gives you a respect and an awe for the package that it goes far beyond conventional scholarship measures, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it was designed. It had to have been designed.
Exactly, exactly. And so once you realize that, then you start discovering how every detail ties to every other detail. It's a tapestry, even though it's in 66 books by over 40 different authors. There's an overruling designer that is diddling the text, if I can put it that way. There's subtle places where you discover it's been edited to carry an additional insight in. And we can go on and on about that. But the point is, it's from that point of view, what I call what's called a very high hermeneutic. A hermeneutics being the study of interpretation. If you take a very, very strict high view of the quality of the text, then you discover all these things tie together and you make much more progress as to what it's trying to get across. But the Nephilim are a strange event in history. But if we understand the passage correctly, it's going to be indicative of the time we're entering into. And now that gets to probably something we'll talk about a little bit. The appearances today of UFOs are so frequent, people ignore them. We had these three or four things that occurred in Israel, and several of them, I think, were hoaxes, but that doesn't mean they all were.
Right.
And so there's it's an area. There are people, I haven't bothered to be frank with you, but some people are really tracking the sightings you see in Mexico and in the Middle East, and they're frequent. And so much so that people are sort of shrug it off.
Is there a pattern to these sightings, Chuck?
Not that I've seen, but I have to be candid with you. I haven't tried to track it lately. The whole area I regard as demonic in the first place. And so once you come to that conclusion,
right,
I take a step back because that's one thing that Jacques Vallée and also J. Allen Hynek pointed out is that they are engaged in an agenda of deceit.
Well, that's in Jacques' book, Messengers of Deception. That's exactly what he points out.
And so trying to study them is just playing their game, if you will. You follow me? And so I really go at it the other way around. I remember Walter Martin used to always say, I never met a demon I liked. It's an area that unless you're doing specialized research of some kind, it's an area that's good to avoid. In fact, in our book, Alien Encounters, near the end, we put a little appendix in there, which is a checklist of someone that for what I call spiritual hygiene. And it's basically a checklist which encourages people to stay away from these things, even such seemingly innocent things like Ouija boards and some of these parlor games
and
so forth.
Let's talk some more about that, Chuck. We're at the top of the hour. Also get into Book of Revelation and End Time Prophecies as well.